cannot just wait for the African Americans to have to defend themselves against black racism. We cannot just wait for the immigrant community to defend itself from the xenophobia and anti-immigrant community. Same thing with the Muslims. This is a collective problem, and this impacts our livelihood and the quality of life in our countries.
A national youth summit on the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II and how that history relates to today's targeting of Muslims, immigrants, and African Americans. Also, protesters gather in D.C. to oppose offshore drilling and to say, keep fossil fuels in the ground. All that and more coming up.
Well, you now have history in the making to stop offshore drilling. Those from the Arctic, those from the Gulf, and those from the Atlantic come together right now and say, we say stop offshore drilling and keep it in the ground right now.
And welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica station for justice, African American classical music. And on Fridays between 10 and 11, it's your place for Voices of Resistance. I'm Esther Rivera. I'm here on the second day for us for the spring membership drive, and it's our first fun drive in our new time slot on Fridays. I hope our listeners have found us and know where we are. So I'm making an appeal to all the listeners, followers of On the Ground to become new or renewing members or to make a contribution for someone else. Turn them on to this Jazz and Justice, this listener-powered public radio station from D.C. So you can get me started by calling 202-588-9739 or pledging right online at WPFWFM.org. I have a goal of $500 for this hour, and I know we should far exceed that. And we always meet our goal or exceed our goal, and I want to keep up that tradition on Friday mornings. Well, today an important national youth summit sponsored by the Smithsonian Museum of American History that took place 2 days ago about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. At that time, the United States government forcibly removed more than 120,000 Japanese Americans from the Pacific Coast. These individuals, two-thirds of them U.S. citizens, were sent to 10 camps built throughout the western interior of the United States. Many would spend the next 3 years living under armed guard behind barbed wire. The summit discussed the relevance of this crime in history to today, when Muslims, immigrants, and African Americans continue to be targeted by the state, politicians, new laws, and policies. So, as always, we have a lot for you today, and we're going to start with our headlines. As part of an historic global protest to keep fossil fuels in the ground, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the White House Sunday to demand an end to offshore drilling in U.S. waters. The protest, dubbed Break Free D.C., was one of hundreds of actions in 13 countries and across six continents. Tens of thousands of activists took to the streets, occupied mines, blocked rail lines, linked arms, paddled in kayaks, and held community meetings. Some participants risked arrest, many for the first time, to say that it's time to break free from the current energy paradigm that is locking the planet into a future of catastrophic climate change. Chantel James has more from the D.C. action.
More than 350 protesters gathered to demand an end to all offshore drilling on the Gulf of Mexico, the Arctic, and the Atlantic coasts. Such practices are ecologically harmful.
When Dr. King stood at the Lincoln Memorial, he had a dream of, and we could be free at last, thank God Almighty, we're free at last. So we also have a dream today. We also have a dream that one day that we will stop using coal and stop using gas and stop using oil and stop drilling in the Gulf Coast and stop drilling in the Arctic. We also have a dream today. That one day that we can transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. We also have a dream today. And while we now say free at last, we hope the next generation won't just say free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty we're free at last. But the next generation will say that we are fossil free at last. Fossil free at last. Thank God Almighty we are fossil.
After a rally including speakers such as Esau Chinook of Alaska and Monique Verdin of the Gulf Coast, protesters gathered in front of the White House to march to the Lincoln Memorial. This is Chantal James for On the Ground, signing off.
Sunday's rally and march occurred 3 days after Shell Oil was forced to shut down an oil platform in the Gulf of Mexico after it spilled nearly 90,000 gallons of crude oil, creating a 26-square-mile slick of 100 miles off the Louisiana coast. The speaker you heard in that report was the Reverend Lennox Yearwood of the Hip Hop Caucus. And for more information about this year's global action to keep fossil fuels in the ground, go to breakfree2016.org. That's breakfree2016.org. And issues of D.C.'s autonomy and home rule are also in the news. Republicans on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee passed a bill this week to block the District of Columbia from enacting a measure to allow the district to spend its own tax dollars without first getting approval from Congress. The measure was ratified by 80% of voters in 2013, confirmed by a D.C. Superior Court, and endorsed by President Obama. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton made headlines when she criticized Republicans for hypocrisy in interfering with the district's local finances.
Now, you do have complete authority. We concede that. What we're asking is for you to delegate that authority to the District of Columbia, just as you have delegated home rule to the District of Columbia. So you contradict yourself. Because 40 years ago, you delegated your, quote, complete authority to the Council of the District of Columbia. We're only asking for you to do that. Hey, shall we bow down and say once again, you have complete authority. This is not statehood, my friend. But let me say what I deeply appreciate. Calling the District of Columbia the nation city. The federal enclave belongs to the nation, but my friend, the District of Columbia, and there's a reason why there's a difference between the words Nation of Columbia and District of Columbia. And let me assert here, whatever is your complete authority, you have no complete authority over me, sir, because I live in the District of Columbia.
The requirement that the district submit its budget for approval greatly complicates city spending and affects matters ranging from the city's bond ratings to its ability to open schools on time each fall. In other local news, Verizon workers continued their strike this week with a march to the White House, a unity rally outside a Verizon store on F Street in downtown D.C., and a benefit fundraiser last night. The workers are staging a National Kids and Families Day of Action tomorrow. Go to standuptoverizon.com for more information. Now, some updates on the Movement for Black Lives. Another black woman, Simone Marshall, has died while in custody at a Texas jail, in a case disturbingly similar to those of Sandra Bland and Jinia McMillan. Simone died from a lack of medical attention after she was taken to jail rather than to a hospital after a car accident. The 22-year-old mother of a 3-year-old daughter died in police custody on Tuesday, May 10th, and Color of Change says that the police, the jails, the medical examiners, and the local press have not reported on it. According to her family, Simone Nicole Marshall was in a terrible car accident on April 26th, when her car flipped over several times before landing in a ditch. Instead of being taken to a hospital, she was taken to the Walker County Jail in Huntsville, Texas, which is approximately an hour north of Houston. Marshall's case files another case of death in police custody of Waukesha Wilson in Los Angeles last month. Also in Los Angeles, there was a victory for a coalition that has pressed the city to investigate and prosecute in the cases of dozens of black female victims of a serial killer dating back to 1985. But the cases were not seriously investigated until recently. Earlier this month, Lonnie David Franklin, Jr., a 57-year-old backyard mechanic, was convicted of killing 9 women and a girl, but he has been linked to other deaths, and a mystery still surrounds the discovery of photos of unidentified women found in his home. There were 181 photos found there. Also in California, the San Francisco police chief resigned yesterday. Police Chief Greg Shore stepped down Thursday after a series of scandals have rocked the department, prompting a federal probe and a public demand for reform, and after the deadly shooting of a black woman in the Bayview neighborhood earlier. Lee had previously expressed, and that's the mayor, had previously expressed confidence in Soar, praising the chief for understanding the need for reform, even as public calls had mounted for his ouster. But the mayor said progress had been too slow. Now, internationally, one of the 276 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram 2 years ago has been rescued. Amina Ali Nkeki and her baby were reunited with her family. Now for more on the international scene is the author and activist Professor Gerald Horn joining us this morning. Good morning, Gerald.
Hello.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can hear you. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So later in the show, we're going to hear speakers at a national youth summit held Wednesday on the topic of the incarceration of Japanese people on the West Coast of the United States during World War II and how that crime against a people relates to the targeting of Muslims, immigrants, and, you know, all people of color today as the right and overt white supremacists have assumed more power. And so I'm looking at that summit, and then yesterday I'm looking at all this coverage of the downing of the Egyptian air flight over the Mediterranean and how it's raised tensions in Europe about terrorism, their definition of terrorism, ISIS, and they're relating that to Islam and Muslims. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how this crash will impact geopolitics.
Well, the crash appears to be significant. There are indications, according to the Egyptian authorities, that point to the participation of religious zealots. Keep in mind that on the Sinai Peninsula, which, as you know, was returned to Egypt after occupation by Israel, there have been very fierce firefights between the Egyptian authorities and these religious zealots. Keep in mind as well that there was a Russian plane that was downed some months ago, and then after first suggesting that it had nothing to do with the zealotry, the Egyptian authorities conceded that it did. Certainly, it's going to raise tensions and pressures in Europe. Already, President Hollande in France has extended the state of emergency. I have to confess, I'm on my way to London in a few days, and I expect to be confronted with something similar there.
Wow. So, I guess speaking of London, I'm wondering how seriously you take this new book by Richard Sheriff, former NATO chief, in this book, and he's been making the rounds on media. In this book, he's saying that NATO is headed for a war with Russia.
It needs really to be taken seriously. Keep in mind that in recent weeks and months in the Baltic Sea, there have been very dangerous encounters between Russian forces and U.S. vessels. This accompanies what is unfolding in the South China Sea, where there have been very dangerous encounters between Chinese vessels and U.S. vessels. Recall that after the Russian seizure of the Crimea a couple of years ago because of its confrontation and contestation with Ukraine, there were sanctions slapped upon Russia. And since that time, relations have headed south, have headed downward. And this book about a so-called war to unfold in 2017 between NATO and Russia needs to be taken very seriously, not only if Donald J. Trump is elected, but I would say particularly if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, because she has expressed, as you know,
yes,
some rather hawkish tendencies.
Yes, and she particularly mentions Russia whenever she is interviewed, or I've watched her in several debate performances. Whenever she's questioned about foreign policy, she will pivot back to Russia very quickly and cite Ukraine and the Crimea from a very hawkish standpoint, as you said, as opposed to looking at the historical precedent there for Russia's space in Crimea, and she continually brings up Russia every time she has an opportunity. So I'm looking at this book with the same type of interest. Now, while the mainstream media here is obsessed with the presidential race, and I, you know, more specifically Trump and Clinton, there are other international events unfolding in addition to this book by Sheriff. You mentioned what's happening in China. I know this week there was a U.S. plane being intercepted by Chinese military there. So how serious is that, and what's that all about?
It's very serious. You know that President Obama is headed to Vietnam in a few days, I believe on Sunday. And this is part of this ongoing encirclement of China. Washington takes very seriously this prognostication that sooner rather than later, the Chinese economy will be larger than that of the U.S. economy. This stirs the deeper recesses of white supremacy. In fact, it really ties into what you're going to be talking about later in the hour about the U.S. contestation and confrontation with Japan in the middle of the 20th century, because, of course, that raised the same kind of specter. There are U.S. bases in Japan, encircling China, and in South Korea, in Northern Australia. Already, with the recent election in the Philippines, we expect a bruising confrontation between the Philippines and China, with the United States expected to back the Philippines. And then, of course, there's India as well, which has very complicated and complex relations with China, to put it mildly. All in all, it's a very dangerous international scenario when we couple what I've just said about Russia with what I've just said about China.
All right. And I see I'm kind of running out of time for this segment, but I did want to ask you about Latin America. Ecuador, Venezuela, and El Salvador have recalled their ambassadors from Brazil following that vote to oust the elected President Dilma Rousseff. And I was wondering if this move signals to you an effort at a united front by these left governments to fight back against this kind of new wave of destabilization in Latin America.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, this impending impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil is quite serious and quite profound and is a gigantic leap backwards. This is coupled with an attempt to prosecute the former president of Argentina, Mrs. Kirchner. Couple that with the increasing attempt to marginalize Bolivia's Evo Morales, and you see that imperialism is on the march in this hemisphere. And certainly this move to recall ambassadors by these Latin American nations should be welcomed, but not only should be welcomed, it should be emulated.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely keep watching all of these issues around the globe. Thank you, Gerald. I hope we can come back to you later in the show to discuss, you know, the relevance of this summit on Japanese internment and what's happening today in our own country.
Please do. Thank you.
Okay. Now, finally, in our culture and media moment, of course, there are programs in our region to mark the birthday of Malcolm X. Tonight, there will be the X Show. Hip Hop celebrates Malcolm X, featuring M1 of Dead Prez at the Blind Wino, 700 Delaware Avenue in Southwest D.C. For tickets, go to Eventbrite. And tomorrow, there will be the Kuzaliwa Conference 2016 in celebration of the life of Brother Malcolm X from noon to 9 p.m. at 2015 Bunker Hill Road Northeast in Washington, D.C. And for more information, go to the Facebook page, May 21, Kuzaliwa Conference 2016, celebration of the life of Brother Malcolm X. Related, the renowned activist who was at Malcolm X's side at his death, Yuri Kochiyama, was honored yesterday with her image on the homepage of Google. I think that's called the Doodle. And there's going to be a major conference here this weekend, the Future of the African American Past, at several locations at the Smithsonian on the National Mall. You can also watch the live stream and view all the papers that will be delivered at the website futurefampast.si.edu. That's futurefampast.si.edu. And finally, next week, Ralph Nader's huge Breaking Through Power Conference with a stellar but not very diverse lineup will be held at the DAR Constitution Hall. I think their website is breakingthroughpower.org. It's going to be huge. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, can what happened to the Japanese in this country during World War II happen again? Stay with us. And in the meantime, call 202-588-9739 or pledge online at WPFWFM.org. 202-588-9739 or pledge online, WPFWFM.org. Stay with us.
Heads up, eyes open, fist clenched. Look here, right on. We say power to the people.
Power to the people.
Right on. We say start a talk going around about terrorism. We say black people are the OBs, the original victims of terrorism. We say political prisoners are victims of terrorism. We say our position is free them all. We say those soldiers in Attica, free them all. What's the goal?
Free them all.
We are Abu Jamal.
Free them all.
Sunday out of the
free them all.
Rochelle's and Cuba Geek, free them all. The New York 3, free them all. Man, we say free all political prisoners and prisoners of war. Free Aaron Patterson, free your brother, put his sister down the street, free those soldiers in Attica again. In the spirit of Harriet Tubman and Sada Shakur, let's see, this movement is organized to be free. That is struggle that we empower the people. Free them all.
To be free, 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 to be free.
To be free,
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 bring it down.
To be free, to be free, to be free.
And welcome back to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Varum here on the second day for us of the Spring Membership Drive, making an appeal to all the listeners and followers of the show to become new or renewing members, 202-588-9739, or pledge right online at wpfwfm.org. I have someone to thank. I want to thank Richard from Annapolis. Thank you so much. He says, keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Richard, so much. We really try hard. We're volunteers, and we're out in the community trying to bring voices from the community to our listeners and across the region. And thank you so much again. And you keep listening. So we'll keep up the good work, and you keep listening. Thank you. And you can join Richard by calling 202-588-9739 or pledging right online at wpfw.org. Now, an important national youth summit sponsored by the Smithsonian Museum of American History took place 2 days ago about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. During that time, the United States government forcibly removed more than 120,000 Japanese Americans from the Pacific Coast. These individuals, two-thirds of them were U.S. citizens, were sent to 10 camps built throughout the United States. Many would spend the next 3 years living under armed guard and behind barbed wire. The summit discussed the relevance of this crime in history to today, when Muslims, immigrants, and African Americans continue to be targeted by the state, politicians, new laws, and policies. Before this part of the program that you'll hear, participants heard from William Shishima, a concentration camp survivor, and Karen Korematsu, whose father, Fred Korematsu, resisted the order to report to a concentration camp and then sued the United States government for herding him and his family into the camp. The moderator is David Ono, who is the co-anchor for ABC7 Eyewitness News in L.A. And there's also Lorraine Benai, an attorney, Hussam Alush, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Mariko Fujimoto Rooks, a junior at Culver City High School in California. Now, you might hear the sound of like someone typing and blogging during the live stream, but you can still hear the participants. Call in now, 202-588-9739.
So we begin our discussion with a set of questions from our online audience, and this first one is from Maria Rigosa and her class in Illinois. So first of all, Maria, thank you very much for sending us in. She writes, what lessons did we learn from this? What legislation came after? So why don't we begin with our legal expert, Lori? What's your response to that question?
Well, there's a whole lot of lessons that certainly one can learn from this really horrible episode in our history. Unfortunately, as we'll be talking about, I'm not sure we've actually learned them as well as we need to, and we keep on needing to relearn them. Some people at the time that the incarceration took place knew that it was wrong, not very many people. So, for example, in Karen's father's case, Fred Korematsu's case, six justices of the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was constitutional to put Japanese Americans into camp. Three justices wrote scathing dissents saying that this was the result of race prejudice and fear. Unfortunately, they were in the minority. As far as lessons to be learned, I think the first lesson is the danger of prejudice and fear. When prejudice and fear combine to result in the targeting of vulnerable communities. We saw that during World War II, Japanese Americans were feared. They were treated like foreigners, spies. People believed that they were going to commit espionage and sabotage, although there was no evidence that they would commit espionage and sabotage. So they were treated as strange other people with weird practices, and that combined with fear that people were going to be involved, there was a war going on, and when you have that prejudice and that ignorance combined with fear of your own security, that often really ends up hurting communities of color, minority communities, the most vulnerable people in our midst. And so we saw that then during World War II when people were treated like they were foreigners and put into camp. And we see that unfortunately now, and we'll be hearing more about that. We see the targeting of Muslim communities. We see people wanting to keep Mexicans from immigrating to this country because they're foreign and they're to be feared. So I think the first lesson is really to educate ourselves about other people and educate ourselves about really who they are, and they're regular, wonderful people not to be feared. Secondly is the need to speak out when you see other people targeted in that fashion. During World War II, very, very few people spoke up on the part of Japanese Americans. The major civil liberties organizations did not come out in full force against what happened to them. And so I think it's up to every single one of us to speak up when we see someone who might just look a little different or dress a little differently. And if you see them being targeted, to speak up on their behalf because they may be less able to speak for themselves.
Wonderful. Karen, you want to add to this?
I think one of the major lessons from my father's Coram Nobis case, that was the term used when we went to reopen my father's Supreme Court case. Coram, the Latin term meaning an error has been made before us. And out of that came the proof that there was government misconduct, that what happens at the time of national stress in this country. And, you know, those issues are still being addressed today. You know, does the government have the right to take away our civil rights and our civil liberties? And after my father's conviction was overturned in 1983, he kept on with educating, crisscrossing this country, and helping with the redress and reparations bill. And as a result of that, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1998. And after he passed away, he passed away in 2005. And in 2010, Governor Schwarzenegger, who was then governor of the state of California, signed the legislative bill establishing Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution on his birthday of January 30th in perpetuity. And now we have the day realized in the state of Hawaii and also the state of Virginia, and other states and legislators, governors have signed proclamations. Even I'll give a shout out to the students at Clearwater Fundamental Middle School in Clearwater, Florida, that wrote letters to their state legislature to establish the day. And one of the lessons that my father tried to really encourage and remember for all is to stand up for what is right. And when you see something wrong, don't be afraid to speak up.
Fantastic. Can you imagine being in your father's position where you're taking on, you're a single individual and you're taking on the United States of America? That is an incredible task. So we do have another question. This is from Stephanie Vistal and her class in Virginia, who asks, does the Japanese American incarceration experience compare to any other period in American history? And if so, how? So let's bring in Hussam Eilish to this conversation. How would you respond to that question?
Sure. I mean, first of all, it's important to remember that historically speaking, we've engaged as a country, unfortunately, in the abuses and violations of various people's rights, from Native Americans to African Americans, slavery to the treatment of Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Irish Americans, Jewish Americans. And nowadays, American Muslims in response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But if we look at all these cases and all these incidents in the past of our history, you know, the common element, while each of them is unique in its own way, there is no one case of abuse that compares exactly to the same other one. But they all have similarities, and that's those similarities are rooted in the fact that, as it was said by Laurie, it's based on prejudice, based on lack of knowledge, ignorance, and fear. Fear usually fueled by irresponsible media or irresponsible political leaders. So, yes, unfortunately, there has been history. And I want to say, maybe after thanking you for hosting the event and being here, I want to say it is truly heartwarming for me to know that the sacrifices of our brothers and sisters in the Japanese-American community did not go to vain or in vain. The fact that we're here building on that legacy to make sure that we prevent another discrimination or targeting of fellow Americans or fellow human beings. We're trying to do that by being here. So especially seeing so many young people who would be and are, as we speak, in positions of making a difference in our country and our world. So thank you for being here.
Fantastic. So, Monica, did you want to handle that question?
Absolutely. I think that it's a phenomenon that's ingrained into our society and into our government. In our very constitution, we have the 3/5 compromise that actually only gives African American people, originally in the constitution, 3/5 the representation of white people. So knowing that we have that sort of inherent discrimination that we are working to fight, and we have seen this evidence, incredible evidence of those who do so, we definitely see some specifics to touch upon some of the things you've mentioned. I recently took the AP US History exam, and without hopefully violating that whole College Board Agreement thing that we all follow, definitely, the Indian Removal Act in the 1830s, passed by Jackson, enacted by Van Buren, came to mind when I heard about this question. The fact that you had the Cherokee on the Trail of Tears that were relocated from Georgia to Oklahoma. Over a fourth of the people died. They were forcefully relocated, much as the Japanese were. And it actually was ruled by the Supreme Court, unlike the Korematsu case, it was ruled unconstitutional in Worcester versus Georgia that people should be relocated. But the government went ahead and did it anyways because the Supreme Court didn't have the power at the time to enforce that decision. So that was something that for me came to mind immediately when I thought of, you know, answering that question.
That's incredible. And that shows you how fragile all our laws really are. If we don't enforce them, and if the masses still rise against our Constitution, then look what happens. That's why we all need to be vigilant. So we want to handle another question here. This is from our online chat. And the question is, this is from Kate. So Kate, thank you for sending this in. Did the apology help you at all emotionally? So Karen, I think this might be directed at you and perhaps maybe how your father felt about all of this, but did the apology help you at all when it comes to redress?
Yes, the apology did, as far as it lifted not only the weight off of his shoulders, but a whole community of Japanese and Japanese Americans who had really lost their dignity and were, you know, accused of for supporting the enemy. I mean, that was what was happening. Just because you look like the enemy means that you were automatically guilty, that you were disloyal, and certainly when we had the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, there were reparations. But what was most important for the entire community that had been incarcerated was the apology. And it's, at least in this country, we have that opportunity to right a wrong when we can present the information. I mean, unfortunately, though, we still have the Latin Japanese that were also brought to this country and incarcerated in like Crystal City, Texas, in Department of Justice camps, and their apology has not been fully realized. So there are still issues out there that we need to continually address.
All right, so I'd love to, since we have a couple of high schools here with us, I'd love to take a question in the audience. I see the mic is making its way towards somebody right over here. All right.
So I had one question. What does the Constitution say about immigrants and their rights?
Laurie, our legal analyst.
So I would say that the Constitution per se doesn't exactly state what happened about immigrant rights. It's a very multi-tiered level of the creation of law in our society, with the Constitution being the supreme law of the land, and then state and federal legislatures making law. But what I will say about the Constitution is, first, affirm with Mariko that it is was at its inception an imperfect document. It was written at a time that it embodied a great deal. Our basic rights as a country, the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom against unreasonable search and seizure, the freedom, the guarantee of equal treatment under the law. So it does aspire to set forth our rights as a people. And at least in theory, federal, state, local governments can't do anything. Their actions can't violate those rights that we have. So that's what the Constitution seeks to do. And federal and state government need to implement kind of what the laws of the land are. Now, that said, in theory, it doesn't always work in actuality. It seems like it should be pretty clear that the governments need to comply with the Constitution. But in reality, oftentimes government actions don't. Oftentimes, the government does things that just seem totally wrong. And so, for example, during World War II, our Constitution was in full force, at least in theory, in effect. We had the Equal Protection Clause. We had all these provisions against unreasonable searches and seizures. But still, this happened to Japanese Americans. We have the Constitution in place. But we still see the targeting of Muslim communities. We still see injustices every day. And so I think what that says is it goes back to the original message, that we need to take responsibility to make sure that the Constitution is enforced and interpreted by our legislators, by our judges, by friends and neighbors, that constitutional rights aren't enforced to protect everybody, because people ask, can this happen again? Can it happen again? I think it can happen again if we as a country let it. And I think that's why some people are really trying to speak out about what's happening to different communities today. Because, as I said, people didn't speak out before and they let it happen. Maybe if we speak out now, we can hold our government to at least what the Constitution aspires to.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard voices from the National Youth Summit, sponsored by the Smithsonian Museum of American History, that took place 2 days ago, about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II and the relevance of this crime in history to today. So this is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Averam, and I am going to a break. But before I do, I want to get you to call in and to become a new or renewing member of this listener-sponsored station. You can call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. You can also pledge right online at wpfwfm.org. This is a labor of love for me and the other volunteers for this show to bring our voices to the air. And we know that you appreciate that and have supported it. And we would love to get your support this morning. 1-800-222-9739 or 202-588-9739. I have someone to thank. I want to thank John from White Plains for making a very, very generous pledge. And I am halfway to my goal, reaching my goal. I only need a few more people to call in and pledge that at that $10 a month level. I know that there are people who want to join the station or would like to renew their membership and who appreciate the coverage that we give to our region. So 202-588-9739. We're going to go to a brief break, and I'll be right back.
Does it gotta come down to this? In order to see things for what they are, for what it is. We still might not be free up in this piece or treated very equally as far as I can see. Hell no, we ain't all right.
Now all these press conferences, breaking news alert, this just in. While your government looks for a war to win. Flames for the blame game, names where I begin. Walls closing and get some help to my kin. Who cares? By the rest of the Bush nation stares as the drama unfolds as we the people under the stairs. 50% of this son of a Bush nation is like hating on Haiti and setting up assassinations. Ask Pat Robinson, quiz him. Smells like terrorism. Racism in the news, still one-sided views. Saying whites find food. Pray for the National Guard who be ready to shoot. Because they be saying us blacks loot.
What is your boy, son of a Bush, doing? Nerd.
New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no.
We ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
I'd just like to add that, our U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, that just recently passed away, was at the University of Hawaii, Richardson School of Law, a few years ago, and a student asked him about my father's Supreme Court case, and he said, well, he thought that had been addressed. But he did say this. He said, you are kidding if you don't think something like the Japanese-American internment can happen again. And then he cited a Latin term, meaning the laws fall silent in times of war. So that's the caution, that we cannot just assume that our civil rights and our civil liberties are always protected, that we do need to stand up collectively and to be sure that our legislators and our courts are accountable.
It's interesting because some would say that we are at a time of war right now as we fight ISIS, we fight terrorism, and Mr. Eilish, I would imagine that you would probably agree that it is happening again, especially to Muslim Americans.
Absolutely. It's, you know, Islamophobia or the anti-Muslim bigotry is a new reality that we all have to live in today, including Muslims who are the main victims of it. I mean, if you ask, if you flip through any channel on TV today, for the most part, not KABC, of course, you would see and you would hear anti-Muslim comments being made by every pundit, every media person, in the most dehumanizing way. And you can imagine the impact of that on the public at large, but also on the young Muslims. You know, I have five kids, and on a regular basis, my kids would come and ask, are we that bad? Are we doing this? And imagine on the impact on people itself, the average person today. This leads to a public that is paranoid. You know, now we hear about Muslims being kicked off airplanes because they're heard saying something in Arabic. Or we hear about Muslim students in high school jokingly being named ISIS, maybe, on your yearbook. Or a bunch of Muslims, maybe because they wear the headscarf, the hijab, being kicked out from a coffee shop in Orange County because somebody probably didn't enjoy it, didn't like seeing them there. So the reality is, even at school levels, in a state that is as progressive, as diverse as California, we did a survey at the public high schools throughout California. We found out that 55% of Muslim students are subjected to physical or verbal bullying in America. This is twice the rate that average American kids go through. So this is a new reality. It impacts our job discrimination, you know, on a daily basis. There is no one day that goes by without receiving 5 to 10 calls and reports nationwide from Muslims who say, I've been discriminated against, I've been attacked. Last year, 3 young American Muslims were killed in Chapel Hill over a parking dispute, supposedly. Just a couple of days ago, we heard about a case of a woman whose hijab, her headscarf, was pulled and called names. The reality is we're dealing with it today. Islamophobia is real. It has an industry that fuels it. And unfortunately, it's something that unless we respond to it collectively, this is not something we can wait. It's exactly the same with any form of bigotry. We cannot just wait for the African Americans to have to defend themselves against black racism. We cannot just wait for the immigrant community to defend itself from the xenophobia and anti-immigrant community. Same thing with the Muslims. This is a collective problem, and this impacts our livelihood and the quality of life in our country. So this is where we attack such bigotry collectively.
And therein lies the relevance of what we're talking about today in this chapter in American history and what we can take from it. So our final question today from a Smithsonian Affiliate Partner Museum, History Colorado, in Denver. So thank you so much for participating. And let's check out our video monitor to see the question.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I live here in Denver, Colorado, Ayatollah Academia. And my question is, how can students address the issue of racial discrimination?
Monica, you want to handle that one?
Okay, well, obviously this is an incredibly complex issue, and there's no one path to being able to lessen discrimination in your community. But I really think as a student that it's really a two-step process. And we've heard a lot of amazing things from the other panelists about talking about change and support. But where that comes from is self-understanding and self-identity. The first part of that being, we all have some sort of privilege in today's society, whether it's racial privilege or gender privilege or something thing as seemingly basic as being able-bodied, and that we all have some form of privilege that is not earned but given. And while that privilege can harm other people, we can also use it to help other people and to be allies of other communities. One example, when we talk about Islamophobia, was that after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about putting all Muslims in concentration camps, similarly to the Japanese Americans during World War II. And the Japanese American community actually stood up and said, no, this has happened before, and this is not right, nor is it constitutional. And it was able, and that didn't happen. And so working with other people and using that sort of privilege and knowledge of your own culture to be able to help others, but also recognizing that if you're from a culture that's historically oppressed, that will play out in media, and it will play out in what you are told you can do and you cannot do, what you think and how you act. And recognize that you can be yourself and you can have self-worth in spite of that. I mean, when was the last time we saw, you know, an Asian male as a protagonist in a movie that wasn't the tech guy or wasn't the evil Chinese villain and was the hero? When was the last time, you know, we saw an African-American woman who was able to be strong and powerful? We have to look for those examples because we don't see them. And as youth, we have to be able to create these examples for ourselves. And one of the worst mistakes, I think, is to follow the philosophy of, you know, colorblindness, where we say that there is no race because there is race, and addressing that is important. And of course, the second part, after we acknowledge, you know, who we are in our society, is to do something about it. And a lot of that is, you know, simple everyday things that we can work on with our education and awareness. I'm both African American and Japanese, so I've heard lots of different forms of, I think, racism in my everyday life. From the Asian American perspective, there's a lot of fetishization, where I hear a lot of, oh, I just love all the Japanese people, I love Japanese culture, everyone Asian is just so nice, or, you know, things like that. And while I'm, you know, thanks for the compliment, it's also, you know, that's a hugely complex culture. In fact, when you talk about Asians, you're talking about an entire continent that's being reduced to one or two adjectives, and it ignores the complexity and the richness of that culture and the depth of it, and even some of the aspects of our culture, you know, that aren't as, you know, nice or quiet. And for me, as someone who is Asian American and someone who isn't, you know, necessarily quiet or submissive, and for other Asian Americans like myself, it definitely, you know, makes us feel like, oh, is this, you know, feel bad about ourselves, or make us worry that we're not being, you know, put, we can't fill that box. So, you know, simple things like that that you wouldn't necessarily think affect us, they do. And I mean, of course, being African American, there's a lot more, you know, examples of overt racism in media. And I mean, but again, simple things like recognizing that music with the N-word, even, or using the N-word with your friends, even if you mean it as a joke, it's not a joke to the people who have been, you know, oppressed for hundreds of years. And even if you don't, even while I say that, you're still going, well, it's still just a joke. Even if you don't understand it, respecting that it means something to other people. And even if you don't understand why people wear hijab or why people, you know, might be offended, respecting that they could be offended and respecting that and going, well, I don't understand it, but I will take it upon myself as an ally of anti-racism to not say and do those things.
Fantastic. All right. Well put. So as you guys and everybody out there, as you think about your role that you yourself and young people should play in addressing discrimination and prejudice, we have one final speaker to hear from, and I'm sure you've heard of him. He's an activist. He's an actor. Mr. George Takei. He was incarcerated during World War II along with his family, and he shared this video message for our program today. So let's take a look.
Our democracy is a people's democracy, and it can be as great as a people can be. The shining ideals that were articulated by the founding fathers. All men are created equal, endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But we're also fallible human beings, and we can make disastrous mistakes. This is a mistake that must never happen again, to imprison people simply because of race. Race prejudice, racial profile, is something that we must always be conscious of and make sure that it doesn't happen in our democracy.
To all our panelists today, thank you so much for joining us. It was an enlightening conversation. I think it was just wonderful. And for all you folks out there and the folks in here in the room, we appreciate you attending this, participating in this, addressing this very important issue. And we want you to continue to think about this issue and think about these lessons from the past and how we can apply these lessons to today. And also think about how you can kind of take them into your communities and share the wisdom. So thank you very much for joining us for the 2016 National Youth Summit. Have a great day, everybody.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard voices from the National Youth Summit sponsored by the Smithsonian Museum of American History that took place 2 days ago about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II and the relevance of this crime in history to today. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avaram, and I have on the line Hadia Amjad, a 16-year-old exchange student from Pakistan at Albert Einstein High School, part of the National Museum of American History's Youth Civic Engagement Program. And she participated in yesterday's summit, and I thank her for joining me this morning. Hadia.
Hi, Esther.
So, what did you think of the summit and the information Wednesday? I know you asked, I think, the first question and heard from a man who was actually a child in the internment camps.
Yes, we met the former Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta, and he was basically telling us about what his experience was and how he has changed the world after being in that incarceration camp and what he feels about discrimination about different races and different religions. Being a Muslim myself and being an exchange student, coming here, I was really terrified because people don't see Muslims in a really positive light nowadays. But after coming to D.C., that was a little lessened. But I think that this summit was really great, and the topic was really interesting because a lot of people are facing discrimination because of their religions and races nowadays.
Okay. Thank you so much, Hadia, for joining me. I'm so glad we were able to just get in one question with you. I'm running short on my time on the show today, but thank you for leaving class to just speak to me for a minute or so. Thank you so much. 202-588-9739 is the number to call. I'm closer to my goal. I want to thank Lauren from Alexandria, and she says, keep up your good work. Well, thank you, Lauren, and keep listening and supporting your listener-powered station. She's a very generous pledge, and you can join Lauren and John this morning who supported the station by calling 202-588-9739. 1-800-222-9739 or pledge right online at wpfw.org. I am very, very close to my goal. I think that I only have about maybe 150 or so to go. So one person pledging at, you know, $15 a month will get it. You can be a sustainer. And being a sustainer is very special because it means that the station can count on that monthly income, which it so desperately needs. And you can make your donation, you know, in increments as opposed to in one piece today. So 202-588-9739. I think I might have Gerald Horn still on the line. He may still be there. Is he still there, Mike? Okay. So I know he wanted to perhaps comment on the program, but that we just heard today. But you can call again, 202-588-9739. I'm very close to my goal. I want to be able to thank you on the air. So please call now. Or you can also pledge online at wpfwfm.org. Okay, so I think that will about do it for us. I will rejoin you at the top of the hour for the Friday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the open mic edition. But until then, please call 202-588-9739. I'm very close to my goal. I want to be able to thank you either this hour or the next hour. And okay, so that will do it for us on the ground. Thanks to Gerald Horn, Hadia Amjad, to Sage Morgan Hubbard at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. You can see the entire National Youth Summit, Japanese American Incarceration in World War II, at americanhistory.si.edu. The program that we were playing from, you can see the whole thing at that website, americanhistory.si.edu. Thanks to all those who pledged, John, Lauren again, and you can join them. Thanks to Lydia Curtis for her reporting on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Thanks to Chantel James for her reporting at Break Free DC. And congratulations to Chantel on her graduation from American University with a master's degree. And so she won't be our intern anymore. She'll be our contributor. We won't call her intern anymore. And thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening and donating. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook page and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Our Facebook page has the green lettering that says On the Ground. And please support WPFW and keep listener powered Liberation Media on the air, 202-588-9739 or WPFWFM.org. Okay, now stay with us for Community Watch and Comment, the open mic edition. 202-588-9739 is the number to call.